This is program C-1121. We are 175 days out from flying to Israel, which sounds like a good long time. But here's the thing. We need to get everybody registered this month so that they can start getting the airline tickets and the hotel rooms and everything like that. So make up your mind now. Check the brochure out, IntoTheWord.net, right there on the front page of the website. You'll see a hot link. Check it out and decide to go with us. It's a great and economical journey, very intimate group that will do this journey together. And make sure you bring your preacher. Talk with the leadership of your church. Do whatever it takes to get him on this flight too. He will come back on fire, having this refreshed, firsthand knowledge of many of the stories he's already been telling you. Well, let's go ahead and get into our study today. We are going to be in Revelation chapter 2, starting at verse number 8. I had been working with the notes from my seminar, Living in the Last Days, which are also on the website, IntoTheWord.net, left-hand side, PDF resources. Look for the Living in the Last Days Prophecy Seminar notes. But here's the deal. We know that because the book of Revelation has its own outline, that chapter 1 is about the things which John saw. That's the introduction, basically, to the visions. And the things which are, which is chapters 2 and 3, which are letters dictated by John from Jesus to the seven churches of Asia. So that's historical to us, but it was the present tense at that time. So I did not include any type of verse-by-verse study in my seminar notes from chapters 1, 2, and 3. I went straight to the things which will take place hereafter, chapter 4 and beyond. So you won't find any of the things we're talking about right now in the seminar notes. I will mention this, that happens to be a footnote in the notes, that I do not accept as legitimate the theory that the seven churches represent subsequent ages of the Christian era. And the reason I don't accept that is because it's a brand new teaching, never even suggested or hinted at in the ancient history of the church. It's much more sensical, I think, to take this as dictated letters to the seven churches, which are listed in the order of their visitation by a messenger making a clockwise visit around the Roman road system of Asia, than to try to put some sort of modern spin on it. And so that's where I'm at, and that's, I guess, my opinion, and it's worth whatever it is you're paying me for. All right, so let's go ahead and get back into the history of these letters. Each of the letters dictated to John by Jesus is pretty much the same structure. The church is addressed. Jesus says something about himself that comes from the book of Revelation in a description of himself. Then there's the body of the letter, which either compliments or critiques or maybe both the church for what it's been doing. And then there's the overcomer section that tells anybody reading this book, this is the reward that will occur for those who overcome in the name of the Lord. So we already looked at the Ephesian letter. That's the very first one. Now we're looking at the Smyrna letter. And remember, again, if you go a clockwise route on the Roman road system, you get to each of these cities in order within about one or two, I think in one occasion, maybe 3 days travel. So now on to Smyrna. Verse number 8. To the angel of the church in Smyrna. Smyrna was a very ancient city of the region. It was one of the chief cities of Asia province. It vied with Ephesus for leadership of the province. It had a very large Jewish population. And when John is writing this letter, we know that the famous second century martyr Polycarp was alive and apparently active at Smyrna. The Apostle John actually did appoint Polycarp as the, quote, bishop or the leading pastor, I suppose, of the church at Smyrna at some juncture, either before this or afterward. And then because of his leadership role there, he was executed as an old man, I think right around 156, might be 166 of the Christian era. So the angel of the church in Smyrna, remember the angel here is probably the guardian angel and therefore represents kind of the spirit of the congregation. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the first and the last, so that's the beginning and the end one, the one who has no beginning, no end, it's Jesus, who was dead and has come to life, that's where we know it's definitely Jesus, says this, I know your tribulation. Now that's when you're being put under a lot of pressure, particularly religious pressure, and your poverty, but you are rich. So the poverty here that's mentioned is probably literal. That is, the tribulation is really making it hard for them to make ends meet. But Jesus reminds them that you're actually rich. And we've seen that concept in other New Testament passages as well as Old Testament principles. That even if we are poor in this world, if we have Christ, if we have a relationship with God, we're actually, we've got everything we need. We are very rich. So I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. Now let's clearly identify who these people are. First of all, they definitely are Jewish. They are ethnic Israelis, but they are ethnic Israelis who have rejected Jesus as their Savior, Yehoshua as HaMashiach. And that is part of the problem, as John has already critiqued in an earlier letter. I want to read to you from 1 John chapter 2, verses 22 and 23, something that John wrote probably about 10 years or so, maybe at the outside 20 years earlier than the book of Revelation. He says, who is the liar but the one who denies that Jesus is Christ, that Yehoshua is HaMashiach? This is the Antichristos. This is the opponent of Christ, the one who denies the Father and the Son. Now listen to this next inspired statement by John, who was Jewish himself. Whoever denies the Son does not have the Father. The one who confesses the Son has the Father also. So the teaching of the New Testament, which is a Jewish book, it is a believing Jewish book. That is, those who believe in Yehoshua as HaMashiach, Jesus as Messiah. The teaching of the New Testament is, if you, as an Israeli, do not accept Yehoshua as your HaMashiach, you are out of relationship with the God who created us and designated Israel as His people. It's just as simple as that. And that means that these guys, because they oppose any type of teaching about Jesus being Messiah, they have joined the other side. They have become opponents of the true Christ. and they are on the side of Satan, the adversary. And it's interesting that John, of course, calls the synagogue there in Smyrna the synagogue of Satan. That language that puts non-believing Jews on the side of the devil is also found in the Gospel of John. It's actually something that Jesus said when he was having a confrontation with the unbelieving leadership of the Jews. John chapter 8, starting at verse 42. Jesus said to them, "If God were your Father, you would love me, for I proceeded forth and have come from God, for I have not even come on my own initiative, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I'm saying? It is because you cannot hear my word. You are of your father, the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I speak the truth, why do you not believe me? He who is of God hears the words of God, and for this reason you do not hear them, because you are not of God." So Jesus is the one that started this, this teaching that to be an unbeliever in his identity was to be an opponent of not just himself, but of God the Father, and to be a supporter of the devil, of the liar from the beginning. And you'll notice that John, in his letters, uses some of that same language when he is saying, you can't reject Jesus and be in relationship with God the Father. And so that's why I think that Jesus here, in the dictated letter to the Smyrnans in Revelation 2, is clearly taking to task the unbelieving synagogue in that city that was opposing the preaching and the teaching and the living of the gospel. Now, how much did they oppose it? Well, verse number 10. "Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be tested, and you will have tribulation for 10 days. Now, some of the commentaries will immediately jump to a day-year theory, which sometimes does work in prophetic things. But since this is a historical book, I think it might be much more literal, that Jesus was warning the people at Smyrna that Satan is going to use his agents there in your town, which could very well be the non-believing Jews of that synagogue we just talked about. Because it says here, the devil's going to cast you into prison, whereas earlier he said that the synagogue was the synagogue of Satan. And so the devil and Satan are synonymous. All right. So the devil is going to cast you into prison, which under Roman custom, Roman action, you were basically in prison not for punishment, but either awaiting trial or awaiting the triggering of whatever the legal remedy of your judgment was. So if you'd been condemned, you would still remain in jail until that condemnation could be carried out, either a death penalty or perhaps you'd be sent off to the salt mine somewhere or something like that. All right, so these guys at Smyrna are being warned that because of their faith, they are going to be in serious trouble, and it's going to really be bad for about 10 days. So it might be like a 10-day roundup of all those in Smyrna that believe in Jesus as Messiah. And he tells them, "Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life." And so this is the reminder that even if they kill you, stay true to your faith, because afterward you will receive the eternal crown of life. You will be in the presence of God the Father and myself, the Son, for eternity. So that's their encouragement, to stick with it. Then comes something that is also common in all of the books. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So each of the churches is supposed to be paying attention to the messages given to the other churches, particularly this last part, because it includes an overcomer comment. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death. Now that phrase, second death, comes up in Revelation chapter 20, because that is the name for being cast into the lake of fire. That is the name for being separated from God for eternity. It's not that they're annihilated. It's not that they go out of existence. It's rather that where they spend their eternity is separated from God, and that is death. So anyone who comes to Jesus and remains faithful and overcomes those who try to interfere with their faith, they don't need to worry about this death that's coming up, the physical death, because they'll never have to die again. They'll always be in the presence of Christ. Revelation chapter 2, verse 12, begins our third book, or our third letter, the third scroll that John is supposed to make sure this congregation hears the book of Revelation. Chapter 2, verse 12, to the angel of the church in Pergamum. Now, Pergamum is the site of a very massive and highly decorated altar of sacrifice to Zeus and Athena. So two of the Roman gods, two of the pagan deities of this time period. This, in fact, might be Satan's throne that Jesus references in just a moment, because Pergamum was very famous for this great big sacrificial altar. So what's he supposed to pass on to this church? The one who has the sharp two-edged sword. And you remember the two-edged sword comes out of the mouth of Jesus back in chapter 1's description of him. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. So if you think about it being a very big tourist trap for all the pagans of the area, that there's all these people coming in there and worshiping Zeus and Athena and the other gods and goddesses at this altar, well, that makes it a stronghold of Satan's counter-revolution against Jesus, against God, against true faith. So I know where you're living. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. But this is what he also knows. And that you hold fast my name and do not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. Now, this is an interesting little historical note. We have no information about Antipas. When you go through the documents like the Ante-Nicene Fathers, no one knows who this guy is, and yet Jesus sees him as very significant at this moment in time. So his martyrdom, his death for his faith, was probably very fresh whenever the book of Revelation was first written. So he becomes the example of what you do when faced with a demand from the pagan side of the equation that you give up your faith or die. The answer is you're going to die. And you're going to die in faithfulness to Jesus. Because remember what we learned from the previous letter, he who is faithful unto death will receive the crown of life. verse number 14. Now comes a critique. But I have a few things against you, because you have there some who hold the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit acts of immorality. So you also have some who are in the same way, hold to the teaching of the Nicolaitans, or the Nicolaitans. Now, the Nicolaitans were mentioned back in chapter 2, verse 6, in the first letter to the Ephesians. They were involved in false teaching in that city as well. Now, who were those Nicolaitans? No one knows for sure. The early church fathers were split on whether or not Nicholas, who was one of the seven, we usually call them deacons, in the book of Acts there in early church history, whether or not Nicholas went bad later and started teaching false things, or that people who took hold of his name and used it in some sort of twisted support for their false teachings. So it's one or the other of those, apparently, according to the early church histories, that the name Nicholas was being invoked here to teach these false teachings. Now, what were they? Well, they were the same sorts of things that went on with the Balaam story. Now, do you remember the Balaam story? That happens during the time of the Exodus. You'll find it in Numbers chapter 31 as one of there's actually several chapters there in Numbers that deal with this. The Moabite king, Balak, was concerned that he could not militarily defeat the Israelis that he was afraid of. They'd actually just defeated, in a couple of weeks, an enemy that had steamrolled over him. So he knew he couldn't beat them in the physical, so he hired this prophet Balaam to curse them in the spiritual. Now, Balaam started out as one of God's prophets, but he had a desire to get the money, the wealth that Balak was promising him. And he tried to curse Israel directly, but God wouldn't let him. You know, he's the guy with the speaking donkey. That's the same story. So when he could not curse Israel directly, he turned around and told Balak, I can't do it, but I can tell you how to get them to curse themselves. You get together some of your young people, and you invite the Israeli young people to come and have music together and dance together and celebrate and worship our little gods and goddesses, and get involved in a sexual relationship, you know, and that will cause God to judge them. And he was right. And God did. God judged a whole bunch of them because they started having these joint celebrations, basically orgies, with the Moabites. And that apparently is at the core of the teaching of these Nicolaitans. That is, there's no problem in mixing with the pagans in their worship services. You can go there to their temples. You can eat the meat that's sacrificed to their idols. And you can even involve yourself in the sexual activity that goes on during those services, and the drunkenness and the overeating. You can do all of that, and you're still fine with God. Now, this sounds very similar to some of the things that John was critiquing in his letters. Remember when we were talking about him dealing with Gnosticism, or the beginnings of Gnosticism, which basically taught what your body does, that can't be held against you by God because bodies are bad, spirit is always pure, and therefore you can just let your body run wild. So the Nicolaitans must have been teaching something similar to that, and Jesus is having nothing with that. So here's his warning. Verse 16, therefore repent, that is, change the way you're thinking and therefore change the way you act, or else I am coming to you quickly and I will make war against them with the sword of my mouth. There's the mouth sword that was mentioned earlier in the letter. He is going to bring judgment against them through some sort of supernatural interaction. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, to him I will give some of the hidden manna. So this would be appropriate food. This might be the golden pot of one day's ration of manna that was in the Ark of the Covenant whenever it disappeared. And we know the Ark of the Covenant ends up in heaven, because that's where it's at in the book of Revelation. So that must be where the hidden manna is as well. So I'm looking forward to having a taste of that. And I will give him a white stone and a new name written on the stone, which no one knows but he who receives it. And of course, this is an indicator of some sort of special intimacy between Jesus and those who overcome. A little secret name, a little pet name, that's only known between him and us, at least at the very beginning. We know Jesus had pet names for several of his apostles, and evidently he must have a pet name for each one of us as well. And so it's going to be written on this white stone. White, of course, symbolizes purity. Stone, this solidity, some sort of solid, can't be broken sort of relationship. And that is something that each one of us as overcomers should look forward to. Well, we're out of time pretty much for today. So we will come back with the next letter tomorrow. And so just keep reading in these two chapters, chapters 2 and 3, to get these letters in your mind, especially the overcomer promises.